Welcome to the Safety Podcast with your host, all the way from a small green island in the wild Atlantic Ocean, Richard Collins.
Hi there, thanks for tuning in and welcome to the Safety Podcast, where we energize and motivate you in the world of health, safety and environment by putting you in touch with real people and their experiences across the HSE space. Our aim is to help you expand your knowledge, develop your career, or just have greater impact in your business. Today on the podcast, we're going to go a little bit further afield than we have so far, actually to the Middle East, more specifically to Qatar, where we're going to chat to Ardell Lawson, who is the HSEQ manager for Hamad International Airport. But before we kick that off, I'd just like to thank all of you who have listened in so far. This is obviously a labour of love at the moment, and I've been encouraged by many of you who have found value already in the Safety Podcast. That said, I would love for you to leave a review, constructive feedback, or leave us a comment and let us know your opinion on some of the issues that are being covered. Much more importantly, though, I'd love to hear your suggestions as to what you would like to hear in future episodes of the Safety Podcast. So please reach out to us, leave a comment in the comments box, or if you like, you can send us a message at info@safety.co.uk. Cool, so let's crack on with today's show. We're going to be speaking to Ardell Lawson, as I said, in Qatar. He's a long-term HSE professional with lots of experience in corporate oil, gas, consulting, manufacturing environments. And he's going to discuss with us his experiences and recommendations when it comes to how to hire the right people. So this conversation, I know, will be really useful for people who are both hiring or looking for an HSE position. So without further ado, let's get on the call. Ardell Lawson, thank you so much for coming on the Safety Podcast all the way from sunny Qatar. Welcome to the show.
Cheers, Richard. Thanks very much.
Obviously, you have a very important health and safety, environmental and quality management role in Qatar at Hamad International Airport, which I'm sure keeps you busy.
Very busy. It's been a busy few months so far. So, I mean, I'm focusing quite a bit on the soft side of the facility management side. So, I mean, a lot of upsailing, a lot of work at height. So that's really been the focus of the airport the last couple of months.
I was reading up a little bit on Hamad International Airport, and I was just looking, you know, at the scale of it, just to let the audience appreciate sort of what you're managing there. Some of the figures, I'm not sure if you're familiar with these figures, but I was reading there was about 40 million odd people in transit across a year in the airport.
That's right. Yeah, it's something around that. I mean, the whole scale of the places is absolutely huge. I mean, you're talking about 600,000 meters squared of property, you know, of area, whether that's obviously the land site or the air site and terminals, the you know, where the planes are. There's quite a few sections to it. And I mean, the place is absolutely huge. So there's a lot of areas to obviously manage with FMM.
I'm sure I was reading there's about 250,000 flights out of it every year as well. And yeah, it's a massive footfall. And I'm sure you have your work cut out for you. It's really...
Yeah, quite a lot.
Really good to have you on the show. I know you've contributed online in a number of articles that you've written recently. And the one we're on to talk about today is the importance of building a strong safety culture by hiring the right safety officers onto your team. Before we get into that, Ardell, do you want to give the audience just a little quick bit about your own background and how you've built your career to date?
I mean, I really started off as an engineer quite probably more about, 17 years ago. So I've got an engineering background. And then from then, obviously, I moved into health and safety. I was a pipeline engineer. From there, I obviously moved into the health and safety side. I was working in health and safety offshore here in the Middle East for quite a few years. I got into the training side of health and safety for quite a while with numerous companies. And pretty much for the last year, I've been in the facilities management industry. So, I mean, it's a new industry for me. My background is oil and gas and construction. So it's been an enjoyable change, a good change. Learned a lot of new things. I did want to obviously look into moving into the facility management industry. And obviously this opportunity came by and I thought it was something I really needed to take. And enjoying it, learning quite a lot.
I think you might have jumped in at the deep end there, maybe.
Yeah, I did, yes.
You definitely, sure. You definitely weren't looking for a soft start with a facility of that scale.
That's right, yeah.
That's obviously interesting that you have quite a varied background.
I mean, it started off when I was working in the oil and gas industry. I mean, we used to do a lot of turnarounds or shutdown periods where the plant gets shut down. And, you know, it was a situation where you get a lot of workers into the plant. You'd be hiring a lot of safety personnel as well to help support the operational teams. And, you know, sometimes obviously those shutdowns would have somewhere around 4,000 employees. So you obviously needed a good, strong health and safety team at the same time to support. And it was obviously then when I started obviously coming across a lot of health and safety officers or specialists or advisors for the various roles. And it was pretty much then where I set a couple of rules normally for hiring of safety officers. I had I got them to do some practical assessments. I focused a lot on the supervisory or the leadership side of things, on their communication. And that's obviously one of the things I wrote about in my article as well, where I highlighted some of the key areas where I started looking at when it came to hiring safety professionals.
I think it could be very valuable for people who are maybe non-safety orientated, or maybe they work in HR and the recruitment side of things, or someone, you know, who is a health and safety and environment professional who's maybe hiring someone for the first time and it's something new to them. This sort of insight could be good for them in terms of giving them an idea of what they should be looking for.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so moving on to that then, we'll take a little walk through some of the things you talked about. You mentioned strongly the importance of a person's attitude towards the role. Can you tell us a bit more about what that actually means to you?
I mean, one of the things for me was, I mean, I always look for the candidate to obviously be quite genuine when it comes to why they actually are in the health and safety business. The way I see it, there's a lot of people in the health and safety business for the wrong reasons. And I always think that the main reason that you are a health and safety professional is because you care about people. And I always need to see that coming through. You're in this business because you don't want people to get hurt. You always want people to go home back to their families, back to their wives or their kids safely. And that's really the priority of why you become a safety professional. It's always something that I try to look for when I look for candidates. And is that coming through? Are they showing that duty of care that I need to see? It's more about why did you get into the safety business? I mean, it's questions like that. You know, what I don't want to hear is, it makes a lot more money than working in the maintenance department or stuff like that. So I mean, that's not really the answers I want to hear, right? I had a certain candidate once. He struck me and he told me this very, very nice story why he got into the safety business. And he said he was an engineer before and that was his background. And he happened to be the first aider when this incident actually happened, where somebody obviously, I think, had a degloving incident and lost a finger. And he was the first aider there. And, you know, that was the first incident he ever actually dealt with. And he saw how the person, obviously, the effect that had on the person afterwards, where he got to work. And obviously, he couldn't use his hands for a certain period of time because of that. And he was off for a certain period of time. And that basically kind of changed his mind into going into the safety field because he thought he could add stuff and he didn't want to see incidents like that at work. So that, for example, stories like that kind of touch me and they get me. It was like, yeah, this guy is obviously doing this for the right reasons. And that's the kind of thing I like to hear, you know, something personal, why you got into that business. Another thing I generally look at as well is I like obviously safety professionals to have a holistic view of how health and safety should be managed. A big question I always ask is, who do you think is normally responsible for health and safety in this company? I like to hear them say everybody's responsible for health and safety. I need them to understand that their job there is really coaching other people into making sure safety is integrated into their day-to-day job. That's really an important thing for me to hear, or how they would go about doing that. They're into obviously coaching people, training people, and trying to change the culture into getting everybody to be responsible for safety. The way that I see a lot of safety professionals, it's a pendulum of two sides, right? One side, you've got people who are more into the policing, the authoritative side of things. And then you've got the other side of the scale of people into behavioral change, right? And then your safety professionals are normally anywhere on that scale. they might have a more authoritarian type of view of things, or more coaching people and behavioral change. Now, I'm not saying one is better than the other. For different industries, obviously, different types of people are needed. But I mean, for me, I do always want to see that whole that they lean towards changing behaviors within a company, rather than I'm just going to be there and I'm going to tell people what to do. Because again, having that whole behavioral change mindset actually adds value to the company long term.
You have made that point in your article about the knowledge of behaviors, and that anyone that you're hiring, you would like to see them have certainly some understanding of that side of the spectrum, even if they are maybe more authoritarian,
right, yes.
or more sort of inclined to that type of approach, that there needs to be balance. Sticking with the theme of culture then, obviously you're speaking from Qatar in the Middle East, and you know the challenges that you have. Clearly, you know, there's a lot of parallels between working in this field across different countries, but also there are a lot of differences. And one of the things that that you mentioned in your article was the cultural awareness side of things when it comes to the local area that you're working in. Can you elaborate on that a bit and tell us your views and experiences on how that has affected your decision-making during the hiring process?
I mean, there's no secret culture plays a big role in health and safety generally, wherever you are. That could be different types of culture, right? I mean, it could be an organizational culture. You could come from an organization which doesn't really care about health and safety as much as your organization does. So they come to your organization and they have to really catch up and learn quickly. Now, the culture could be the different nationalities or the different backgrounds or different religions that people come from. Over here in Qatar, for example, we get a lot of laborers and a lot of personnel who come from the Indian subcontinent. I mean, a lot of them, for example, it's the first time that they come to work on projects, and it's the first time they're actually out of their country. And they've never actually been exposed to health and safety regulations before. They don't know what PPE is, why they need to be wearing PPE, why they need to follow safety precautions, why they need to basically have top rails and mid rails on a scaffolding. A lot of these concepts are quite alien to them. So, I mean, getting people, for example, from Europe, going and working in the Middle East and seeing a lot of this, sometimes it comes across as very shocking. But I mean, for me, it's kind of normal. You know, I kind of expect that. A lot of times you get projects and you get personnel who just do not have that experience. And it's a lot about coaching and working with them and training them in quite a short period of time to catch up and understand why the basic, why you have the basic safety rules. Behavioral safety programs have actually helped quite a bit, because it does touch on the whole cultural aspect of stuff. It does touch on why, obviously, you need to take safety as a priority, because obviously you want to go back to your families. We don't want to see people get hurt and so on and so on. That normally comes across quite strong to cultures who are not used to, obviously, the whole health and safety side of the business.
I think it's very interesting and definitely useful for people to understand the complexities that can exist when you have such a cultural mix as you have in the Middle East, and obviously to understand the challenges that can then present.
Quite a few challenges. I mean, one of the examples I always give was probably around, when was it, between 2008 to 2010, I was working on a project with Shell, which is building the biggest gas-to-liquid plant in the world. That's actually built in the north of Qatar in a place called Ras Laffan, basically in the north tip of Qatar. I mean, on that project, during the construction phase, or the peak of the construction phase, we had about 65 different nationalities, and I think we had about 55 different languages. That was crazy. They had developed a program, and it was the first time that had been done in industry, and I think it set the example for a lot of other projects or a lot of other plants within the region. And so Shell spent a lot of money to actually develop a training center where they said, okay, this is going to be very, very difficult to handle this with the different languages. So what we'll do is we'll have groups of people within the same languages, and then we'll have a supervisor who can speak both English and the language of the work crew. So they could speak, obviously they could speak both languages, and then we'll focus a lot on the supervisors to give the supervisors the basic leadership and competencies that they need to manage that team. So they can communicate with the management in English and obviously understand the permits and the pre-task discussions and so on, so on. But they could actually explain the steps of the job, or look at the hazards of the job, or teach their crew to look at hazards of the job in their own language. That was the area of focus, to actually concentrate on developing the supervisors. And I remember a lot of their basic training for the supervisory level was 11 days. So, I mean, they had to go through 11 days, full days of training, where a lot of that was a trainer-trainer, communication, you know, a little bit on leadership. So, I mean, a lot of them were soft skills, which had nothing to do with their job, but it was just the basic training to make sure that communication is there and they pay attention to the safety elements of their work. And it worked very, very well. I remember we had a team of about 20 trainers in different languages who are working pretty much full time, sometimes 24 hours as well, to obviously accommodate for all the people who are coming through. And it worked very, very well. I mean, that project had an excellent safety record, given all the challenges.
Fascinating to hear a story such as that. And I've heard similar stories of projects like that around the world, and it definitely blows my mind to think about how that is all coordinated. And it's definitely impressive for someone who would be looking to, for instance, move into somewhere such as the Middle East to work. Whenever you're assessing their suitability for it, if they haven't got the cultural awareness, is it possible for them to be trained up by a company, or would you be looking for specific milestones for them to have already reached before they even try to apply for a job?
If I'm actually looking to get people in the Middle East for certain projects, I mean, I do actually have preference for people who have been working in the Middle East, because they understand that whole culture, initial culture shock or culture barrier is kind of gone. So they do understand that. And it does take a certain amount of time to understand it, because it's, I mean, coming from the UK or coming from the Americas or anywhere like that for the first time, you're not going to get it straight away. And a lot of things are going to seem very strange to you. You do need to be engulfed in it for a certain amount of time to actually get it. So I do actually focus on people who have that background. Now, I'm not saying that people can't get used to it. Yeah, of course they can. I got used to it, right? I mean, a lot of other people from the UK, from Europe, from America are here and obviously get used to the culture. It depends, however, on the projects as well. I mean, a lot of times if I'm hiring for a short-term project, which is 3 or 4 months, I'd rather just focus on someone who's local rather than get someone from the outside. However, I mean, again, based on the expertise as well, if it's more for a long-term thing, I'm happy enough, obviously, to have someone, get them to go through the cultural aspects of where they're working.
Okay, I think that's pretty clear. Once you do get someone, sort of you're lining someone up and you're thinking they're a good cultural fit, and then you start looking into their ability to actually communicate well with the audience via training and so forth. You're mentioning that you look for all-rounders and people who are not afraid to be able to deliver training to, you know, different audiences and different members of an organization. What are the key things you would look for in terms of someone being a suitable trainer or someone who looks like they have the right credentials to deliver for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite helpful. I mean, I like to see good communicators, especially if they're supervisors. I mean, safety officers, advisors themselves, you're often obviously going to be training, you're going to be conducting a toolbox talk, you're going to be supporting supervisors doing toolbox talks or pre-task discussions or explaining JSAs or method statements, that kind of thing. So I do like them to have some basic good presentation skills. So, I mean, a lot of times when we are hiring HSE officers, I always ask them to basically have a presentation prepared. So they'll come and obviously do a 10-minute presentation of their own choosing on excavation safety or working at height or confined space safety. And, you know, their presentation skills and how they engage with an audience is actually assessed as well. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to go into a classroom and they're going to be teaching. However, they are going to be doing, again, toolbox talks with the workers, with the work crew. And that obviously is something that they need to have. So that whole training element of it is something that I look at as well. And it's, I mean, it doesn't always have to be there, but it's always an added bonus.
I think that's a very important skill for people in the industry, to ensure that they're always developing that ability. Or depending on where you're working, you know, you may not have to personally deliver that much training, but certainly as you move forward into other roles, that may be a major part of it. Ardal, you moved on to talk about the importance of professional accreditations for applicants. Now, this is nothing new, of course, and no matter where you look in the world, generally you will expect to see a requirement for some form of professional membership or accreditation when someone is applying for a health, safety or environmental job. Having said that, in the podcast previous to this with Carl Mannion, I discussed the importance of accreditation in terms of businesses being able to identify competence. But to be honest, there was quite a bit of a mixed opinion on that in terms of the actual validity and I guess the importance of it. Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts around that and how you use it in the selection process?
I'm definitely quite big on that. I mean, I do like to see obviously things like obviously chartered members or tech members for the different positions that we're looking in. Again, just like you said, to go through those accreditations or those associations, you need to obviously go through a peer review and you go through a CPD process. I'm sure you've done the same, Richard, as well with IOSH as well. But I mean, it's not just IOSH there. There's the CSP, the American ones, there's the Canadian ones. Again, wherever you are, you might have these certain associations that might be required for those certain countries. I mean, in Dubai, for example, or the United Arab Emirates, they've started their own now. They've got the OSHAD, which is a certification that you go through similar to our IOSH. I know there's similar ones in Singapore, for example, for safety officers. A lot of the guys from Nigeria as well, they have their own certifications when it comes to Nigeria or working there locally. So a lot of these guys obviously have their own country certifications, or obviously there's the more recognized ones like the IOSH, the CSP, or the anytime obviously I need a background check, I can always ask for your number, and you can always contact someone there, and I have done that a few times as well, and they'll give you a little bit of the background and, you know, what level you are.
Yes, there's always some accountability there for you to actually actively go and check the credibility or the genuinity of whatever level the person's claiming to be at. I suppose that provides some reassurance to an employer. And in terms of qualifications more generally, then, Ardal, you had discussed earlier, and I find it interesting because I've done something similar myself, moving from one industry to another. I've done that a couple of times, and intentionally to broaden my experience within the HSE field. You were saying that just because someone doesn't necessarily fit the specific sector experience is by no means a reason to discount them as being suitable for a role, and I'm glad to see that. But going into that a little bit deeper then, how do you view people who are coming from one industry to another generally? You know, if it's obviously yourself, you move from construction, oil and gas, and then into facilities management. If someone was going that direction or vice versa, what is your sort of view of that, and how does that impact your thought process when you're looking at a CV or considering somebody for a position?
It does impact it a little bit. I mean, you always want to have the best fit, right? So, I mean, if you have someone who's within the same area that you're looking at or within the same industry, you're always going to give them the preference. I mean, I think it goes without saying. But I mean, there's a few industries that you can probably put together. I mean, if you're mining, oil and gas, energy, construction, you can pretty much put those together. I mean, they're very, very similar hazards, very similar risks in those industries. Engineering industries, for example, fabrications, facility management, those are obviously very, very close as well. And then obviously on the other side, you've got things like pharmaceuticals or biological type hazards and that kind of thing, which are, or the nuclear side of things, which are a little bit different. So, you know, again, there's different categories, but some of them are very, very similar. Some industries are very similar, and it's quite easier to move in between.
Well, I think that's important for employers, if anyone's listening, you know, either now or in the future, to that, just to consider that a lot of these industries, there are quite a lot of crossover in terms of the hazards that are being dealt with. And, you know, those with experience in construction can certainly bring a lot of value to the table when moving into many other industries, and the same goes for a lot of different sectors. That's good. And has your, since moving into facilities management, would you say you've become more liberal to that idea since you've done it or not?
I definitely have. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'm still learning. I mean, it's the first time that I came across MUPS, for example. So I'm starting to learn about like boom lifts and scissor lifts and things like that. Obviously, in oil and gas, you'd never use those. You'd always build a scaffold to do what you need to do. Very rare that you would use like spider lifts or something like that on an offshore plant or even an onshore plant. So, I mean, these are things obviously I'm becoming a little bit more used to. Things like abseiling, for example, that's quite big on the facility management side of things, but you hardly ever see it in oil and gas or construction. I mean, there's certain obviously jobs which are, some of them are quite high risk as well, which obviously exist in some industries that are not very prevalent in other industries. And I mean, these are things that you need to obviously learn about, you need to read up about, you need to consult with your peers and get some of their experiences on how to control these hazards. But I mean, other than that, facilities management still has confined spaces, still has a lot of your normal working at height. There's a lot of excavation work if you're involved with the civil side. There's a lot of lockout tagouts. There's a lot of electrical work. So, I mean, these are things which are, you know, similar in different industries. But again, there are some elements of it which are quite different.
When you're in an industry for a long time, there is a risk that you become too familiar with the hazards and that, you know, your level of, you know, of working or competence, you know, may be at risk purely by the fact that you've been doing the same thing for so long. Whereas if you change tact and introduce some new learning to your experience, then it sort of invigorates you a bit and motivates you to investigate, you know, the ins and outs of new activities and new ways of working, which I think from a personal perspective is a good thing in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I'm glad that you agree on that point, and it's encouraging for other people who maybe want a change of industry out there as well. Hopefully they can take some reassurance from that. Just for people who, you know, are looking at this from the point of view of becoming employed or changing their role or, you know, are trying to progress in their career, you've had a pretty prevalent career through some very high-risk industries and some very high-profile industries and high-profile projects. Is there anything that you would do differently if you were to go back 10 or 15 years and, you know, look at the path you've taken you know, is there anything that you can provide to the audience that might help them on their own journey?
I'd probably be a little bit more open to trying different things or looking into different industries or taking on a bit more challenges. I spent quite a lot of time in the training side of things. I thought I was quite good at it, and I kind of stayed out. I mean, I had opportunities to go into more advisory roles and things like that, but I just, you know, decided to keep to my area of comfort. I mean, it was just a little bit later on when I just became a bit more experienced, and obviously I thought I had a bit more knowledge of other things, and I decided to delve into other areas of health and safety. But I probably should have done that a little bit sooner, and obviously also a little bit earlier, and challenged myself a little bit more. I think that would be my advice to anybody listening, to always try and challenge yourself. There, you're never going to be an expert going into going to the site for the first time. You're always going to start consulting with your peers and understanding the site before you can actually give some credible advice to how things need to be done. So it's not something that that you need to worry about. You're never going to know everything when you go into a job for the first time. And there is quite a bit of learning that you need to go through. There's a lot of communication with people around you. And that's basically how you learn, and that's how you start contributing.
That's a fantastic point to finish on, I think, really, for people, you know, to encourage them to put themselves out of their comfort zones and take on a new challenge. And in a lot of cases, they have the skills and knowledge to move into a different area or onto a different project. I think a lot of people will take value from that statement itself. I think we could all learn a bit from that just in life in general, I think, at times.
It doesn't have to just be for work.
No, you can take a leap of faith now and again, and you know, the rewards are greater in the end. Look, thanks again, Ardo, for coming
on.
And taking this call. It's a bit later in Qatar than it is here in the UK, so I appreciate it.
Cheers, Richard. Thanks very much for having me on.
No problem, and hopefully we'll hear from you again in the future, and keep up the good work writing all your articles and feeding some useful information back into the industry. I'm sure people are getting great benefit from it.
Great. Thanks very much, Richard.
Okay, so that was Ardell Lawson over in Qatar, or Qatar, depending on how you want to pronounce it. What you didn't know was that that was actually the second recording of our call on this subject. So because of technical issues, the first session we recorded didn't actually record Ardell's part of the conversation. So I'd just like to thank Ardell again for being so patient with the whole podcasting process. You're a gentleman, and hopefully we'll get you back on the show in the future. Very briefly, I just want to summarize the key takeaways from that conversation. Number one was the importance of knowing about behavioural safety and the human factors in the HSE profession. Obviously, Ardell had touched on the point that having an authoritarian approach on its own is not sufficient in his eyes. So that's an important takeaway. The second thing was specifically looking at the Middle East as an example, the importance of having a cultural awareness and appreciating the challenges around training and the spectrum of competence and awareness for health and safety and environment when you're working in challenging projects and if you're thinking of moving to a different country, for example. So I thought that was really useful. The next thing then was he had identified the criticality of someone who was coming onto his team being a good communicator. So essentially he was saying that they must have or be able to demonstrate good training experience and have the ability to communicate at different levels within an organization. So again, very valuable. The next point was that accreditations matter. Effectively, Ardell was saying that certainly in terms of the paper-based exercise of the hiring process, that it's really something that is quite critical in terms of actually defining or selecting, narrowing down candidates. So that's something to bear in mind. And I think regardless of what your opinion is on how important these accreditations are or how meaningful they are, they definitely add credence to your case if you're applying for a job. I think you would be quite hard pushed to find an HSE position where this wasn't part of the essential criteria. The next big takeaway was the importance of being aware that a lot of the skills that people have in the HSE space are transferable across different sectors. Although Ardell had highlighted that certain sectors do marry up better than others, as he has demonstrated himself, and as I know from my own experience, it's very much possible to transition or laterally move across into a different sector within the HSE space. Many of the skills that we have are transferable across different sectors. Of course, he did mention, and he was honest about the fact that if someone has specific sector experience relevant to the job he was hiring for, that they would certainly get preference. But this by no means should put you off from challenging yourself to move into a different area if you feel like it's the right thing to do. That leads us very nicely into the last point that he made when he reflected on what he would change, having looked back on his career to date. He simply said that he should have taken himself out of his comfort zone much earlier than he actually did. So folks, I think that's a good point to end on. I'd love to know your thoughts on this conversation. Hopefully you got some value from it. Once again, and sorry to keep going on about it, but please let us know what you'd like to hear on the next Safety Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll catch you again in the future.